my first DMT experience changed everything I thought about the world. Yeah. And
the Joe Rogan podcast you're listening to is hugely popular.
That's the aliens, an utterly alien realm filled with alien intelligences who communicate. And of course, again, the skeptics say, oh, it's all just made up in your brain, but we don't know that. And don't.
This interview with Graham Hancock drew millions of listeners. It's quite a statement regarding how far our culture has come in trying to understand the relationship between psychedelics and consciousness.
What's good, YouTube? Spiral Out 9704 coming at you.
But this next clip may be even more
remarkable. In one of my videos, there was a comment left asking me if I could make a video explaining why I don't use entheogens any longer.
It's from Spiral Out 90704. And was published for the benefit of his 342 subscribers. It's titled, Why I No Longer Use Entheogens. And while the numbers may not be as impressive as the Joe Rogan interview with Graham Hancock, the thousands of trip reports available on YouTube may be an even more significant statement about what's going on with entheogens in our culture. But what does it all mean? And what are we supposed to do? Graham?
Can we use changes in consciousness to understand the majestic complexity of the universe in which we live? And I think the answer is definitely yes. And
Spiral Out 90704?
People need to understand that the mind is a very fragile thing. It can be bent in so many strange directions, and some people's mind can't be bent as much as others and remain intact.
Stick around for a show on entheogens and my interview with Cody McConey. Coming up next on Skeptico. Today we welcome Cody McConey to Skeptico. Cody is the creator and co-host of the Silly Rabbits podcast. Silly Rabbits is kind of a play on the idea of psilocybin, which is one of the things that Cody is very interested in talking about and bringing to people on his very interesting and relatively new podcast. So I ran across Cody. He connected with me a couple months ago about this recent paper that he's published about the possible connection between Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church, and psychedelics. And that led to a very interesting dialogue between us about this whole topic of entheogens, which we've talked about before on Skeptico, but have never really pulled apart, I feel like, in true Skeptico fashion. So that's what I asked Cody if he was up for, and you said yes, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm excited. Let's dive in.
Yeah, let's do it. It's really interesting. So let's start by, I gave people just a very brief sketch of your bio and your introduction and what you're doing. But tell us more about what's going on with Silly Rabbits podcast and what you're doing with some of your other research and work.
Well, my wife and I started Silly Rabbits podcast a couple months ago. We both have found psychedelic use to be of great benefit to both of us. And so we kind of study it as a side hobby and wanted to share some of that knowledge with the rest of the world. And that's just kind of the reason why we did that. In regards to the paper I co-authored with my research partner, Bryce Blankenagel, he does the Naked Mormonism podcast. I started listening to his podcast a little over a year ago, and as I was listening, I started noticing things as he went through the story, and I contacted him, and we just started going back and forth, and started writing a paper, and just recently presented at the Sunstone Symposium in Utah on that.
And you guys, I have to just tell people, if they check out your podcast, it isn't like your usual kind of psychonaut, trippy, hey man. I mean, it's like really intellectual and academic, and you get all these really smart people on there and with a lot of references to academic papers and research. So that's part of the angle that you're bringing to it, right, Cody?
Yeah, thank you. I'm a avid reader, as is my wife, and there's a lot of misinformation in the community right now. I think people tend to latch on to information that falls in line with their worldview. And part of the reason why we started the podcast was just kind of help sort out the bad information from the good information and just help people move forward responsibly.
Wow, that sounds like a real skeptico kind of ethos. I love it. So here's what I thought we'd do. Speaking of kind of skeptico ethos process, I have this process that I've kind of formalized over the years, but really kind of crystallized it into a formula in the last few episodes. And it's three steps. Follow the data, look for the conspiratorial angle. And in this case, we got some really interesting stuff there. And then third, find the deep spirituality. And I think all three of those are going to fit in perfectly with this topic of entheogens and psychedelics. So maybe a place to start is, let's make sure that our definitions are clear. Tell me what you think we're talking about when we talk about psychedelics and when we talk about entheogens.
It definitely gets problematic for an experience that's so ineffable to try and put it into small mouth noises. But psychedelics, as we kind of understand them today, I think is generally associated with drug use in the 1960s and the whole hippie movement and whatnot. The term entheogen was coined in, I think, 79. By Ruck, Carl Ruck, and Jonathan Ott, and I think Hoffman as well, to kind of distinguish a different form of substance use that delineated from drug use. I think the biggest thing is intention when it comes to the difference between psychedelics and entheogen use. This intent to elicit an experience with the divine or some type of mystical spiritual experience.
Excellent. And let me nail that down further. I think I'm in total agreement with you. I'm going to share with folks the two definitions that pop up if you just Google those terms. The first, for psychedelics, right to your point, relating to drugs that produce hallucinations and apparent expansion of consciousness. Interesting there. I'm going to pull that word out of there in a second, apparent, because I think it's really important. And second, with entheogens, a chemical substance typically of plant origin that is ingested to produce a non-ordinary state of consciousness for religious or spiritual purposes. Again, exactly to your point about intent. But what I wanted to highlight, and I thought we might have an interesting time discussing, is that word apparent. Because I think it's really easy to gloss over what that really is driving at. And I have a clip I want to play that I think will maybe get us there. This is from a YouTube video promoting the Interdisciplinary Conference on Psychedelic Research. So this is serious research by academics, neuroscientists, psychologists, psychiatrists, all sorts of people like that, who are doing, this is a relatively new thing over the last few years, and it's a very exciting thing for some people, and that is that real university researchers are exploring psychedelics and entheogens, even though that's in the title. But I want to play for you this recording, and then we'll talk about it. Here goes.
Psychedelic drug psilocybin seems to break down a particularly high-level system in the brain, which is related to our sense of self. And there seems to be something potentially useful therapeutically in that breaking away of the sense of self.
And if these chemicals can be harnessed in a way to improve those lives of those patients, then we owe it to them to study them.
Okay, so right off the bat, let me just toss it to you. What did you get out of that? What kind of sparked your interest in that?
The bit about responsible use leading to beneficial changes in one's life, however you want to interpret that, I think is what interests me the most. That's actually kind of how I got into this. I suffered from chronic migraines as a kid, and I did, just by happenstance, I did a report on LSD in high school, and it said, I remember it saying something about Hoffman looking for a cure for migraines or cluster headaches, and that's how he kind of stumbled upon these ergot alkaloids. And so when I was offered LSD at 19, I wasn't really interested in the hallucinations or the psychedelic experience. I was more interested in alleviating my migraine symptoms. And two things happened. One, I had a full-blown mystical experience, and having grown up in a very religious household, that was something I had never, ever come across. And second, I went 4 months for the first time in my life without having a migraine. And I did not do it in the best or most responsible setting, and it was difficult at times, but it had a major impact on my life. It certainly changed it for the better. And I think it comes to mind the study John Hopkins did, where they did a broad spectrum analysis of trip reports, and even people who reported bad trips, so to speak, something like 85-86% of them came away with some type of beneficial outlook on the experience itself, even though it was difficult.
Cool. So we should talk about that, because there's definitely some, we can't put it in any other way, there's some medical benefits that we can directly tie, like we do in medicine, to, you know, PTSD, depression, like you said, migraines, there's other things. And that's definitely emerging from the research, right? That's your understanding?
Yeah, and like you said earlier, this is really new research. I mean, they're pretty legit people doing the research. There's John Hopkins, the people at MAPS, the Beckley Foundation. There's a few in Switzerland and Germany as well. I think the University of Jerusalem does this too. But it is brand new. The social taboo on drugs and psychedelics in particular has only recently begun to change. I think Strassman had a lot to do with that, and Rick Doblin in particular. But it's pretty new, like you said. We're only scratching the surface.
So let me twist things a little bit on the axis here and talk about that definition I had before and the word I was picking out, this apparent expansion of consciousness. Because one thing I picked up on in that quote, and I agree with all the great stuff that they're doing, and heck, I mean, the field was totally abandoned for the longest time. So it's awesome that researchers are coming in and availing themselves to these medicines, these substances, and seeing what they do, because we do have so many reports that they can be beneficial. At the same time, I do hesitate a little bit at the kind of underlying philosophical kind of brain-based approach that they're taking. From one of the very first things that the guy says in that clip I played is, hey, it does appear that psilocybin is breaking through the brain kind of structure and this and that. So again, they are going to be packing this back into the current neurological model that consciousness is brain-based. Is that okay? Are there limits to that? What might those limits be? What are your thoughts on that?
I think psychedelics are a great way of showing us what we don't know. And when it comes to the materialistic kind of brain-based model of consciousness, I think this is a nice bridge for the non-materialists or the people that are uncomfortable with the materialistic model. I think it allows for an empirical view at consciousness or the nature of consciousness. It allows for a repeatable experience, but it is there is still this kind of mystical, ineffable quality that people have a really hard time articulating until they've had the experience themselves. So a lot like near-death experience. I know you do a lot of research in that field as well.
Right. So, okay, well, I'll tell you what, let me just go forward with this and it'll further draw maybe out this discussion we're having, because you mentioned a second ago Strassman, and you're referring, of course, to DMT researcher, the first person we should say that with over a 30-year period, there's like this total blackout by the FDA and the government that no one is to look at these substances, test these substances, the doctors, researchers, no one's to touch this. And then they give this guy at the University of New Mexico, physician, psychiatrist, Dr. Rick Strassman, they give him permission to use DMT, which is a very interesting substance. A lot of people know it through ayahuasca, that very fashionable kind of go to Peru and have your psychonautic kind of experience with ayahuasca kind of trip. But anyways, they isolated the compound, the active compound in that, which is DMT. Of course, you know all this. I'm just saying this for the benefit of listeners who don't. And then Rick Strassman looks at this in the lab with volunteers. And I want to play for folks from my interview with Rick what he said about it, about the experiments.
The most interesting results were that high doses of DMT seemed to allow the consciousness of our volunteers to enter an out-of-body, freestanding, independent realm of existence inhabited by beings of light who oftentimes were expecting the volunteers and with whom the volunteers interacted. Okay, so correct if any of that's wrong, and just also if you want to elaborate on that, because that's quite a lot for people to kind of wrap their minds on around right from the beginning.
Right, right. Well, that's pretty much the case. You know, that's true. Everything you said.
Everything I said, because I was quoting him, I wasn't making that up, is true. I mean, compare that for a minute, Cody. You did a nice job of kind of holding up the current research and how it might be a bridge from the material science to the immaterial science. Don't we have to kind of do more than a bridge? We need a huge leap to get over the gap between what Strassman is laying out in terms of the topology of this consciousness field versus where we are in science, don't we?
Oh, for sure. There definitely an epistemological shift has to take place. A social mindset needs to be completely changed in how we look at drugs and the nature of consciousness and just reality in general. I guess what I was meaning to say when it comes to the bridge is this might be a good way to get the materialists on our side, so to speak, because this experience is so repeatable and it can be offered to people at a statistically reliable rate. If you dial in dose, set, and setting, you can elicit a very profound mystical experience in people. It's something like 95% or higher. And so I think offering this experience in a socially and kind of medically responsible way is maybe how we get the materialists to maybe see what it is they don't know about reality and consciousness in general.
But even in the process, when we talk about it in that way, I think a lot of people are going to feel like they have one foot on the deck and one foot in the boat in terms of now we're trying to apply very materialistic sounding processes and controls and those kind of things to something that by Rick's definition and by the definition of many experiencers completely doesn't fit within that paradigm, right? So we say, okay, take this dose in this setting and you will achieve this. And then we have a bunch of people who are kind of on the other side of the consciousness issue and saying, as Rick did, hey, there's this whole other realm that we don't understand. We don't understand, therefore, what this realm is. We don't understand, you mentioned a minute ago, what our reality really is anymore. So doesn't that lead to some fundamental questions about
you know, what's 95%? What does that mean? What is, you know, 7 grams or 5 micrograms, whatever the substance or the, what does any of that mean? And we'll talk about that, I think, later when we talk about the deep spirituality, but let's stay grounded in the kind of material medical world for a minute. And do you get what I'm talking about in terms of this kind of way we struggle with kind of backdoor materialism when we're talking about expanded consciousness?
I do think it is hard to science certain aspects of this, for sure. Like I said, when my first experience, I didn't follow any guidelines. I really even have any intent of having any kind of mystical experience. That just happened on its own. I think of like neuroscientists who talk about our reality just being one massive hallucination, or our perception of reality being a hallucination. And that these chemicals just act as like filtering mechanisms, or inhibiting these filtering mechanisms in our brain.
So I guess the question would be, does it matter more or less? If we just apply that model, you know, and you have some experience, can you just go off the experience? Does it matter if we understand the mechanics for how it works? I mean, one thing I see here is we're kind of doing a shut up and calculate version, which I always like to say, you know, in quantum physics, they ran into the philosophical dilemma of what does this mean? And they couldn't handle the philosophical questions associated with quantum physics. So they said, well, screw it, just shut up and calculate and let's make all this cool stuff, which they made. And that's why we have cell phones and computers today. Well, are we doing the same thing with psychedelics and theogens, where we're saying, okay, well, shut up and calculate, take this dose like this, and just see what happens and forget about the philosophical implications of what that means for the larger question of what the heck is consciousness? What is our relationship to this consciousness field, or whatever we want to call it?
I think there's a definite move in the psychedelic research field to try and legitimize this socially. And the way they're doing that is through science and kind of approaching this from a clinical aspect. I'm kind of personally of the opinion it doesn't really matter. I think we're too early in the research to be able to come to any conclusion about what it is. And what matters to me is that just the experience, you can have the experience. Is it real? Is it just, you know, chemicals in your brain? I really don't care. I spent my entire life in a religious household. Like I said, I spent a large portion of my life actually genuinely searching for a mystical experience. And when I kind of stumbled upon it, with LSD, it was so, profoundly indescribable, that when I came out of it, I didn't really care if it was real or not. The fact is I had it, and the fact is I could have it again. I don't know if that helps answer your question.
I think it does. Like, that's very good. So with that, too, let's move on to the second part of my little process here. And that is, as I like to say, look for the conspiracy. And when we, for some folks, they may not think there's much there, but man, there is a lot there. So let me start with this. I don't know what you know or what your opinion is on this. So that's going to be kind of fun to explore it together. Cody, tell me what you know about MKUltra.
Honestly, not much. I know it's a government mind control program that was instituted, I think, in the early 50s at first. And there were different iterations of it. I know there was a few different Ultra programs that kind of got pushed back in the limelight when MKUltra came out. And they kind of used MKUltra as a way of... Nothing going on here. Nothing going on. We've taken care of the problem. And I know there was a lot of people in the psychedelic community in the early days have been accused of being involved with that, or helping the CIA with their mind control experiments.
I think that's a good intro. And I think it also kind of highlights a couple of points I'd like to talk about in terms of MKUltra. Because the first thing that I think people need to know is, one, there's, when you mention MKUltra right off the bat, there's some scoffing, you know, all that conspiracy nonsense or something like that. I mean, MKUltra is, is real. I mean, I'll give you a quote from the U.S. Supreme Court, no less, because they were sued over MK Ultra. The CIA was sued, and it was brought all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says what MK Ultra is. This is from the Supreme Court. MK Ultra was concerned with the research and development of chemical, biological, and radiological materials capable of employment in clandestine operations to control human behavior. And then it goes on to, again from the Supreme Court, to talk about the extent of it and the crimes and the horrible kind of things that they did. And it was huge. That's one thing I want to add and get out there in this show, is that people need to know, again from the Supreme Court, 149 sub-projects, various universities, all sorts of institutions, 80 institutions, 185 private researchers, and that's only the part that they disclosed and know about. So they were in this kind of massive full-bore effort to understand and weaponize and control the human mind. And we can talk for a minute why they would want to do that, or whether that's completely Orwellian, or whether there was actually some sense to it. But what they wind up doing is bringing LSD into the equation in a major way. And yeah, all those early people who introduce and promote LSD all wind up having all these links back to the CIA, as do some of these other players that I think we're going to talk about. So before we get too deep into the woods, I guess what I'm trying to pull out here and bring to people's attention and talk a little bit about with you is, do we have to be concerned that these clandestine operations, these secret, hidden, deep state operations, were from the beginning deeply involved in a win-at-all-cost effort to use these substances to control people? Does that concern you?
Oh, certainly. And we kind of touch on this in the paper on Mormonism. We were intentionally gentle and nice about it, but there's a lot of evidence that Joseph Smith flat out was just using this to as a mind control agent, and was just drugging his congregation.
So this is Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon religion. Give us the date and give us maybe just a brief sketch of what you discovered.
Well, it's well known in Mormon history that Joseph Smith in his early teen years had a career as a ceremonial magician. He was kind of running around with these guys who, it was a popular hobby to go out in the middle of the night and treasure dig, where you'd use like ceremonial necromantic rites to raise treasure guardian spirits that would tell you where treasures were and whatnot. And later in his career, before he starts the church, there's a lot of evidence that his parents and he and the treasure diggers were using psychedelic plant medicines in their treasure digging and magical rites. And then later, when they started the church in 1830, Joseph Smith and the hierarchy spread the message around, and you kind of see these tendrils of psychedelic use reach as the missionaries approach new areas. You see evidence of psychedelics being used, especially in Kirtland. Just a year after the church was founded, there's a doctor in Kirtland, Ohio, who is accusing the Mormons of drugging their congregation in the sacrament practices. And similarly, I think that there's a great conjunction between like magical or hypnotic practices or mesmerism used with or in conjunction with psychedelics that kind of ups the ante. It just amps everything up to 11. And I think that's what the CIA was interested in. They were trying to create the perfect spy, whereas Joseph Smith was trying to create the perfect parishioner.
I think that's a great lead-in in some ways, but I don't know that we can limit it to that. I mean, your point is extremely well taken about this interleaving and overlaying of the occult, of magic practices, of mind control, and of these substances right in there. I mean, Jack Parsons, Aleister Crowley, they're directly tied into the very early stages of before MK Ultra, because they were looking at this stuff way before the 50s, right? But Jack Parsons.
Yeah, and they were both using psychedelics too.
They're using whatever they can get their hands on. They're using, and they're not afraid of using, you know, demonology, magic practices, whatever. And part of it is understandable in that they feel that there's a threat. I mean, as soon as you know this stuff is out there, if you are a protector of our freedom, then you have to say, hey, how can this be used against us? So it's a defensive thing. At least that's how it's always sold to us. But as we all know, the crossover between defensive and offensive is often just a transparent flip of the switch. But this leads into an interesting kind of thing to pull apart. So your Mormonism investigation, I think, ties right into this conspiratorial mind control. Let's have our guard up about what's really going on when we play around with these extended consciousness realms, given that we don't really know what these realms are and what we're getting into. Do you have any concerns or apprehension about that?
Yeah, I'd actually borrow an argument from the gun community and say that a hammer can be used to build a shelter for your family, and it can also be used to destroy that same shelter and kill your family. It just depends on how you want to use that tool. And you have to be responsible, you have to know how to use it, and you have to educate yourself. And again, that's kind of why we started the podcast, is just to help people parse out the good info from the bad info. And there's a lot of it out there. And I think in order to responsibly use these tools, we have to appreciate that they can be used for nefarious purposes as well as beneficial ones. You were talking about MK Ultra. This gets a little conspiratorial, but there's some evidence that Charles Manson and Timothy McVeigh were involved in the MK Ultra experiments. And maybe that's why they did what they did.
Oh, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, it's known. It's documented. We just don't know all the records because they're sealed and all the rest of that. But they were doing whatever they could. And then when the experiments went wrong, and we don't even know if they went wrong or if that's what their intent was, they wound up with some very strange kind of things coming out of it. And they also seem to be kind of balancing, undecided, playing both sides in terms of what we were talking about earlier, in terms of the mind equals brain, materialistic consciousness is an illusion side, which says, oh, we have these chemicals. We can give them to people and our biological robots will act this way, versus these other people on the other side are going, hey, dude, this is magic, man. This is completely of a different realm. And there's these spiritual entities that are getting involved in a way that you don't even understand. So forget your biological robot. So, I mean, this I know is a lot for people to hold in their head, but this is the space we're in, because this was always an ongoing debate, even within the clandestine deep state exploration of this. That's my read of it. Do you have any opinion on that?
Yeah, I think, like I said, with the tools, it can be used for anything. And I think of a culture like Central America that you find it being used for divination, for diagnosis and healing. You find it in hunting rites, and they were also drugging up slaves and cutting their hearts out on top of pyramids. I think you can use these substances any way you really put your mind to. And because they appear to expand our consciousness, perhaps that makes us a little malleable. They can also be used as deprogramming agents. I think that's why eventually the government kind of threw out their LSD experiments, because it was kind of hard to dial in which result you would get. And again, that kind of goes to the inability to really science these things, because even when you give somebody this dose in this setting and they have this intent, sometimes the trip goes sideways, you know?
I think that's well said, and I like how you're bringing in the cross-cultural part, because I want to return in a later show to this issue of the conspiracy, and in particular the deep state MK Ultra thing. And I have to credit Joe Atwell, who's a guy I have a lot of respect for, and he really turned me on to some of this with Wasson and Padraich, and we'll talk about that later. But I'm sorry, we'll talk about that in another episode of Skeptico, because you've really done a nice job, and I'm kind of dragged you into an area that isn't your expertise. But then again, you kind of, it is, because I like the way you connected it to the Joseph Smith stuff. But what you just brought on the table kind of brings an interesting connection with another guy I think has had some interesting things to say on that, and that's Gordon White, who we both know and does the excellent Ruin Soup podcast. And he just had a very interesting interview with a woman and...
Bia Labate.
Bia Labate. There we go. Awesome. And Gordon did a great interview with her. And one of the things that came out of that interview, and it was like a throwaway point that went in a different direction that I thought was so interesting, is she goes, okay, I've tried to trace this back as far as I can in the kind of anthropological sense in terms of the use of this. And it ties in directly to what you're saying, Cody. She goes, hey, the first use was in warfare to see if our enemies were going to attack and how to attack them. And you go, whoa, wait a minute. I thought we were talking about spiritual, stuff. Now you're saying it's about warfare? That's how you, that was the first documented use of it that we can pull from the record, and or hunting, or, you know, all this other stuff. So again, maybe we have to look at our cultural overlay in terms of the spirituality connection with this. And you just talked about that, but maybe you want to expound on it a little bit.
One thing my wife is particularly interested in, she's Amanda on the podcast. She has a theory that this is the, well, it's not her theory, she's expanding on it, but that this is the origin of sacrament, this practice of ingesting a substance, or ingesting a substance that elicits this experience of mysticism in a religious setting is a particular interest. But if you go back much earlier, it's, again, like you said, you see it being used in warfare and hunting. Some have postulated that agriculture was actually used to, some of these substances are highly variable and susceptible to seasonal and predation and different variables that leave them either seasonally or annually unavailable.
Cody, play that out a little bit. Expand on that in very simple terms that people would understand, because it's a profound point that you're making about how we even know that these substances exist, right?
Well, they're a lot more prevalent than people think. I actually have Datura growing in my yard right now. It's a lot of these plants are what people would think of as weeds, mushrooms, and a lot of the psychedelics are what we think of as weeds. They're wildcraft plants. You don't really have to plant them. They just kind of travel through the air and plant themselves. But they are highly susceptible to like insects, environmental factors, and they can, say you have a really good mushroom spot, and just one year, for whatever reason, it's too dry, or the rains came too late, and it just doesn't fruit that year. And so what I was saying about agriculture, some people think that this agriculture was originally invented in order to make these substances more readily available, and that the sustaining food side of it was just kind of a beneficial byproduct that took over. But yeah, you see, the earlier you go back, the more broad spectrum the use is. You see it being used for almost everything, not just sacrament and mysticism and magic and whatnot.
See, that's really interesting. And actually, you took it in a direction that I didn't see, which is very interesting. But I thought you were going to take it in this other direction. Maybe you want to comment on is you look at something like ayahuasca and you say, okay, the complex chemical process that's going on in the ingestion of ayahuasca is crazy, man. It's like, okay, you take this root that you have to harvest in this way and cook with this and combine it with this other substance over here in this way. And if you do it just right, you get this experience. And then you go to the shaman and you go, how did you know to do this? And he goes, oh, I was in an extended consciousness realm and the plants told me, you know, so that's the other part when you talk about the, it's almost, again, the flip side of the agricultural thing of what you're saying is that, hey, we are embedded in this extended consciousness realm and we pop in and out of it. And, you know, maybe we need to have a different relationship to understanding how these substances even come into being. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what you said earlier about kind of tearing away our own social or modern viewpoints and trying to put our heads in the place of our ancestors in different cultures is really hard. But you mentioned the ayahuasca, for example, when they say the plants told us and that they were in a visionary state when they found the plants, that could mean a lot of things to me. As somebody that I'm a permaculture designer, I work a lot with plants, and although they don't speak English, plants do speak with you on a certain level. If you can learn their language, their color, their spotting, their, they'll tell you when they need nutrients, when they need water, when they need things from you, their caretaker, especially anybody who's grown cannabis knows this. Plants have a personality and they do tend to talk to you if you're sensitive to that. And if you're in an open state, like you would be under the influence of a psychedelic and you grew up with that type of plant literacy, I could easily see how you would explain it like, hey, the plants told me. When we hear that, it sounds very mystical and very, whoa, that's really cool. How did that happen? But I think if we tear away our modern perception of that and just look at it from how they would have been, these people would have been raised in the forest, how they would have been daily harvesting some of these plants for other things, it's very easy to see how, like, one day a little bit of the cappy vine fell in the mimosa bark tea and made something we did not expect. And that just became a socially practiced thing.
Maybe, but then again, that's not what Strassman is telling us. Strassman is telling us there's this freestanding realm and these entities are waiting there for us and saying, glad you're here. What took you so long? And the shamanic experience is telling us that over and over again, that these beings consistently reported, some of them at least, consistently reported cross-culturally, are on the other side and are imparting this exact kind of information. Take this plant, take it in the spring when it looks like this. The shamans say they walked me through the forest and said, take this plant when the leaves look like this and combine it with this. So, I mean, maybe what you're saying, but maybe the other too. We don't know.
Yeah, and I won't discredit that entirely. Like that, I totally am open to the idea that it could be completely unexplainable from a materialistic standpoint. I just kind of tend to leap for that explanation just to keep the conversation going. But yeah, I think that's totally plausible as well.
Well, tell you what, let's move on because we've already kind of dipped into this, but I want to kind of formalize the discussion of the deep spirituality of entheogens. It's implied in the definition, as we said. I mean, that's the distinction people are making between psychedelics and entheogens is the intent, purpose of the use for entheogens. It's to expand our spirituality. And let's look at what we understand that to be. Maybe let me just toss it back to you and right off the bat get your ideas or your thoughts in terms of how this connects with spirituality, your spirituality, or a larger spirituality, if you will.
I think this might go back to the consciousness discussion and kind of how the materialistic model just doesn't really fit. One thing I find really interesting is that cross-culturally and cross-time, people ingesting certain substances will experience kind of the plant guardian, if you will, or like the being that resides in that plant. Or sometimes it's just a vehicle to the other side. But there does seem to be these archetypal beings that are described, and however you perceive them, I think when you get a few people in a room together who have had an experience, you'll find it's fun to watch them piece together how they viewed the same people. I've heard a lady who described her mushroom trip as frustrating because this giant elephant man with one tusk just kept staring at her the whole time, and it was really annoying. And she had no idea who Ganesh was, but anybody in the room who came from maybe a Hindu background could have pointed that out pretty quickly. I think that's a really interesting thing that says a lot about consciousness and just how little we know about what's going on, is that, you know, we can all kind of see these archetypes on the other side when we're under the influence. And I'd also like to point out that not everybody has to use these. There are some people that seem to just kind of endogenously be able to elicit this individually. When I talk about the statistical reliability, I'm more referencing just group experiences. But on an individual basis, like, you can do this a number of ways. Stanislav Grof has done a lot of good work with the holotropic breath work, which is just kind of an expansion of like Hatha yoga. And prayer, meditation, there's dancing, there's a lot of different ways to do this.
To that end, I have one more clip that I wanted to play for us, and it's from former Harvard University professor and former colleague of probably the most famous founder or mover in the psychedelic movement, Dr. Timothy Leary, and that would be Dr. Richard Alpert, better known as Ram Dass. So let me play for folks this clip from Ram Dass about his experience in introducing LSD to his spiritual master, Neem Karoli Baba, who is this barefoot sage that he meets in India and immediately feels is the source of his spiritual guide, his everything, and somebody who many thousands or hundreds of thousands of people have identified as being this significant spiritual saintly kind of figure, that is Neem Karoli Baba. So here Ram Dass is talking about giving LSD to Neem Karoli Baba. Here goes.
And I just think this is going to be pretty interesting, you know, and nothing happens at all. Nothing. So I go back to the States and I tell everybody this guy took 900 micrograms and nothing happened. Because, I mean, this is our medicine. I'm impressed, you know. But I mean, in the back of my mind is the gnawing question, do you suppose he really swallowed it? Maybe he veiled my mind and threw it over his shoulder or something like that, you know. But I don't know. So I come back to India 2 years later, and I find him after about 6 months, and he says to me, first time I come up to him, he says, did you give me some medicine last time you were in India? I said, yeah. He said, did I take it? I said, I think so. He said, what happened? I said, nothing. You got any more of that medicine? So I said, yeah. So I brought out, and I had 5 pills, 300 each. And one of them was broken. He wouldn't take the broken one. He took the 4 others. And he took each one, and he stuck it on his tongue. And he made absolutely sure that I saw that he took it all in. Then he said, can I have water? And I said, yeah, pani. Garam to hot or cold? I said, doesn't matter. So he called for water and he drank some water. He said, will it make me pugla? Will it make me crazy? I said, probably. And at one point he went under his blanket and then he came back down looking absolutely mad. And I thought, what have I done to this poor old man? He doesn't understand the power of our medicine, and he probably did throw it over his shoulder last time, and I've trapped him into taking it. Oh, my God, how can I live with this and all this? And then when he had me totally paranoid, he laughed in glee, and nothing happened. And then he said, these were known about thousands of years ago. He said, in the Indus Valley, in the Kulu Valley, he said, But he said, most of that's been forgotten now. Yogis don't do the preparations for this kind of experience anymore. They did fasting and they did things before this. And
so we'll let Ram Dass kind of fade out there. There's a lot to pull apart there that I think relates to this discussion we want to have on deep spirituality. First, and this is a point that's easy to gloss over, is we're talking about a psi effect here, if you will, that is way beyond what we accept. And that is this reading of the mind, right? So his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, is reading his mind and knows that he has had this kind of question about this substance. So already we're kind of moonshot out of the kind of ordinary experience. And then two, obviously, the point of the story as it relates to psychedelics is these psychedelics don't affect him because his, we are to assume, that's implied, his consciousness is developed in a way that allows him to choose what realm he moves into and out of and how that all works. Again, it gets to, you know, what we're talking about, Cody, in terms of what is really going on and what is this experimentation really all about? And then thirdly, he kind of says very matter-of-factly, yeah, well, they're medicine and they used to be around and we forgot how to use it and it can still be useful. But I just think this is a clip that launches us into this discussion in so many angles about what is the deep spirituality of these substances. So with that, let me pull you in and see, what do you take out of that?
I think you're correct, or I agree with you in your reading that the Maharaji was an advanced being, or he had trained his mind, however you want to explain it. He had his mind just was able to flow in and out of states of reality that we other people, we hard cases, do not normally get to experience or see. I can't remember his name at the moment. There's a visionary artist who has a tumor on his pineal gland and his art is stunning. It looks like the DMT experience. So I think there are people that like on the natch can get to these spaces. And these spaces, when I say that, this is very nuanced, it seems like different drugs can take you to different places, different intent, different meditation, different, like there's so many variables to this. We've only scratched the surface research wise. It's really hard to nail down how any of this works, but like with Neem Karoli Baba, I think the most interesting thing is that it didn't work on him. And I personally have never seen anybody that could take 1200 micrograms and be unaffected. But I think the interesting thing for me and for people that maybe are first hearing about this is, for those of us who aren't Neem Karoli Baba, for those of us who are maybe a bit more hard-headed or have not expanded our consciousness or are not as advanced as him, we can use these chemicals to maybe get a glimpse at that side of things or how maybe he perceives reality all the time.
What about that rather famous quote from Alan Watts, another psychonaut who had this to say about psychedelic experience? I love this. When you get the message, hang up the phone. That's what kind of connects me to the Neem Karoli Baba thing. What do you think Alan Watts meant, and how does that kind of inform you or inform this experience for you personally?
I take that that quote is highlighting integration. I think a lot of the times when you have a really profound experience, it takes a long time to just pull it apart and dissect it. And what the hell does this all mean? I think after my first LSD experience, I think it was over a year before I did it again, just because it was so... took me a long time to pull that apart. A big problem I see right now with the psychedelic community, and not to cast any major judgments, but I think people tend to use these substances a little too often and don't take time to hang up the phone, like you said. I'm sure Alan Watts picked up the phone from time to time, but you don't need to be on the line the whole time, I think is his point.
Nice. Cody, tell folks more about what's going on at Silly Rabbits Podcast and the other stuff that's going on for you.
We're still evolving. We're still pretty new, like you said. The first few episodes I just started putting out just to get the thing going, because it's kind of a beast to just get it rolling. So we started out with interviews. I've been studying this for 5 or 6 years now. My wife's been studying it for about as long. And so we started to piece together little kind of info segments and with the interviews, but largely people will find authors in the field. We kind of give them a platform to talk about their book and what they're working on. And then maybe we usually do a follow-up or a complimentary segment that has to do with a tangential field. Like with Jerry Brown, was recently on our podcast. I know he was on Skeptical a little while ago. I did a follow-up segment on John Allegro and kind of the birth of this theory as Jesus as a mushroom. So we hit a lot of different fields. We're trying to bring a more nuanced discussion to this topic. And we have a lot of new exciting stuff coming up. We're going to have some exclusive Patreon content coming out soon. That's just kind of a breakdown of research papers and whatnot. So that's something to look forward to. And we're both kind of writing books on tangential topics. It's a very broad spectrum field. But the paper you mentioned that I wrote with Bryce Blankenagel, we're in the process of expanding that into a book or a set of books.
And that, again, is on the Mormonism, psychedelic, and theogen connection with Joseph Smith, which you teed up a little bit and sounds very intriguing. I know a lot of people find that interesting.
Yeah, we did a couple episodes on it, actually. If you go on Silly Rabbits, the episodes with Bryce Blankenagel, we essentially just read our research paper and kind of go off on little digressions to explain some of the finer points. So if you don't have the time to read it, you can stop by and check those episodes out. I think that's number 10 and 11.
Great. So again, our guest has been Cody Nacone from Silly Rabbits Podcast. That's spelled with a P and then silly. Silly Rabbits for the, you get it anyways. I'll have a link to it in the show. And Cody, it's been great having you on. Thanks again for joining me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time and giving me a platform to rant about psychedelics.
Thanks again to Cody Nacone for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the one question I'd have to tee up from this interview is, what do you make of the renewed interest in entheogens? It's not all that new, but it certainly has been going on for a few years, and it seems to be gaining more and more momentum. Is it good? Are there some powerful, deep spiritual implications and consciousness-advancing implications? Or not? Let me hear your thoughts. Of course, the place to do it is at skeptico.com, S-K-E-P-T-I-K-O, where you can catch up on all the previous episodes of Skeptico. And from there, you can also jump on over to the Skeptico forum and let us hear from you there. I have some interesting shows coming up. I do hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.